Welcome to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden, your host. Glad you could join me. Hoping I'll be able to help you along a little bit on the adventure we call dog training, bird hunting, and adventuring in the great outdoors as we are learning from our dogs, and hopefully they're learning from us as well. Great show in store for you. Of course, a public access tip that will get you into some new hunting areas, free of charge, of course. Some hunting strategy and dog handling advice. And our guest this week, a guy that seems to know his stuff from both angles. Seth Bynum is a sportsman, just like you and me, a hunter, an angler, and a doctor of veterinary medicine. A lot of you have sent me notes on Facebook regarding the questions we should ask him, and I'm going to do my best to cover them all. So Omar, Mike, Carolyn, Clarkson, and everybody else, stand by. We'll get to your questions as soon as we can. In the meanwhile, how's your week going? Here we still have another week left in the season, and I am grateful for that because Flick's been on the injured reserve list. Knocked a toenail out. I can only imagine how painful that was. He's on the mend, but it is pretty bad, and I've been trying to keep him slow and steady and not too active for about 2 weeks now. And believe me, a young German wire hair, not active. You can imagine what our house is like. I hope yours is doing well. I hope you're getting out for a few more days if you got a season left. If you don't, hope you're planning next year's season already. One of the things I'm planning for, and I hope I'll see you there, is the Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever Pheasant Fest and Quail Classic. It's in Minneapolis this year. Hope I can see you there. It's in February. Look it up. Just Google 2020 Pheasant Fest and you'll find the main page and you'll get the rundown on who's doing what where. My booth will be right next door to my friends at Legacy Sports. Those are the folks who make that great pointer shotgun. You might have seen the review I did in shotgunlife.com a few days ago. Look forward to talking with you about bird dogs, bird hunting, and all that other stuff. Got some other great announcements for you, but I'll keep those for later because the important stuff happens right now, including Sage and Breaker Mercantile, our longtime sponsor. Been here since the beginning. I know it's not that long, but sure appreciate it. Fred, thank you very much. Did you learn your lesson the hard way on the Christmas rush? Well, they got most of their stuff back in stock now. You can avoid that disappointment in the past by signing up for their mailing list. You'll get advance notice on all the new products and all the specials before everybody else. Go to sageandbreaker.com. And Dogtra T&B Dual Collars. You know how much I love them. No toggling back and forth from dog A to dog B or the front end to the back end in Flick's case as we learn two skills at once. Learn more about the Dogtra T&B dual collar system at dogtra.com. So joining me on the line right now, Seth Bynum. He's a doctor of veterinary medicine, but he's also one of us, everybody. He's a bird dog owner and a former, as a side job, he's doing some writing and photography for all sorts of folks. Seth, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Is that a fair kind of description? You got a day job, but you're still doing all that other fun stuff?
Oh yeah, I think you nailed it. Now there's like this relief to not have to depend on the photography and writing to pay the rent and do it for fun and as I want to, not because I have to.
Well, good on you. And I admire whatever the hell intestinal fortitude you had to have to go back and become a veterinarian. What prompted that?
You know, I've said this before. So there's two types of people that I encounter in vet school. There's the ones that always knew they wanted to be a veterinarian from the time they were very little. And then there's the rest of us. And I was sort of in that latter camp. Yeah, and I'm not sure what it was. Being in journalism for a number of years, you could sort of see this was, prior to the recession, see the writing on the wall that I may not have a job within the next 12 to 24 months. And we were sitting around having a beer and you know, with our dogs. And like, well, what could you do? I'm like, well, I don't know. Maybe I could be a veterinarian. I thought, no, there's no way I would get all the way through school again, because I was a political science major, you know, started out liberal arts degree. So I had to go back and start from scratch. And I thought, well, let's just get on the train and see where it goes. I'll probably have to hop off early, but, you know, who knows what happens. And then, you know, 6 years of school later, there I am.
Wow. Well, good for you, and congratulations. You've been practicing now for a while up there in Lewiston, Idaho, one of my favorite towns in the state of Idaho, by the way. And I haven't been up there for steelhead for quite a while, but I need to get back. But in the meanwhile, how's your hunting season going?
Yeah, pretty well. We've done some road trips, which has been great. Met some new friends along the way. And then I've been kind of slow around the holidays, but looking forward to picking it back up in the finale here. As you probably know, I do a lot of checker hunting. And then I think the season, in my opinion, just gets hot right about now. So we're trying to finish strong at the end of the month.
Pardon the pun. It might be hot from an action standpoint, but this is about the coldest part of the season for us. But I'm like you. I'd rather have that ground frozen solid than that gumbo mud that we have to negotiate on the way down some of those hills.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, you mentioned something that I've been really amazed with myself personally this year. My goal this year is never to hunt any place I've hunted before. And the side benefit of all of that has been meeting all sorts of new people in new places. And you know, all you got to do is talk about dogs or talk about hunting, and all of a sudden these people are like your long-lost brother-in-law.
I found that to be true as well. Yeah. And then that's a lofty goal you have, trying new stuff. I always like to keep some predictable things in my back pocket, just because I don't want to spend the whole year, you know, chasing new habitat and not finding anything to shoot.
Well, it is. There is that dilemma. Absolutely. You know, I came across you in a couple of ways. One is follow the meateater.com a little bit, and you're writing the Ask the Vet column for those guys. You're also a bird dog vet on Instagram, and you got a heck of a lot of followers. I got to get some advice on that from you.
I'm sure I'm the one to ask in that regard. It just sort of happened spontaneously. I haven't been doing much to promote it, but I joke with folks that I've been taking pictures of my dogs and out doing hunting and scenery and just for years. And then it just finally found a sympathetic audience that wanted to see it. I think Instagram has been the perfect platform for that to happen.
No doubt about it. And they're beautiful. So anybody out there who wants to learn more about Seth's photography, Bird Dog Vet is where you go on Instagram. And if you want to learn more about what he's doing in the way of advising us, the meateater.com is a good place to start. Ask the Vet. You know, we got probably a dozen or more questions from followers of the podcast that I want to get to. But the first thing I want to ask you is probably the highest priority. And that is, if you had to narrow it down to one or two of the most important ways for us to keep a hunting dog healthy and conditioned, what would you tell us? What's your prescription?
Sure. There's one, and then everything else is like a distant two and beyond. So yeah. The number one thing, and this is the most common thing I see in practice related to the health of bird dogs, is body condition. So not just in terms of being in physical shape, I'm talking about weight and the amount of body fat that's carried on there. So we, you know, I've mentioned this in some of my stories, and I tell every client that comes in, we're in the midst of a pet obesity, dog obesity epidemic. And the more than 60%, somewhere between 60 and 70% of my patients are overweight. So if there's one thing you could narrow on that contributes to so many problems across the spectrum for bird dogs, it would be obesity. So just the simple fact of keeping your dog lean, and not so much for the pointer crowd, because that seems to happen a little bit easier without as much effort, because they just are just vibrating and burning energy all the time. But definitely as you move into the retriever spectrum, then you're looking at, you know, dogs that are having issues frequently, and it can be all attributed to what is essentially a preventable disease.
You know, I got to be careful. My tongue is faster than my brain quite often. And, you know, when I see a Labrador retriever that is in good shape, I will remark on it to the owner. And I think all the other Labrador owners I know are mad at me when I do that.
I said that very same thing in my veterinary school interview, which about when I'm stepping out of my way to give someone a compliment when they kept their lab in good shape. And hey, maybe that's what got me in. It resonated with somebody else too. But I think it's worth pointing it out because we've just lost perspective on, I think, as maybe with ourselves as humans, we've lost perspective on what a healthy dog looks like.
Yeah. And if you watch the dog shows on TV, of course, I'm not suggesting that that's the kind of dog that we want, but they're virtually all overweight, at least in my opinion. And then if you watch a lot of the, even a field trial situation, you'll see a lot of that. And it is a little bit scary. If we want to just a thumbnail, you know, quick way to determine that, is it the one that we see on the poster on all the veterinarians' offices walls? You look down at your dog for a waist.
Yeah, absolutely. I put that on the back of the exam room door. So while it's shut and we're talking, I'll say, if you'll turn around and take a look, you know, Buster here, he's way down at the bottom. We need to kind of have him climb back up a few rungs there too. Yeah, so
good.
Yeah, it's a good one. Purina makes one. I think Hills has one that's very similar in terms of scoring body condition.
Yeah, funny how all the folks who feed dogs want us to feed our dogs less quite often.
True. That's a good point.
So you know, once a week I get a question from somebody about, you know, what's in your dog first aid kit? And I don't want you to give me your list. I want you to give me one of the items in your list that we probably hadn't thought about.
Oh, listening to your show, I bet you thought of all the ones on there. I'll preface that by saying that I've been really fortunate that my dogs have not had any catastrophes in the field. So by virtue of that, I keep slimming down the contents of that kit.
Yeah.
More and more and more. I would say that something that you should keep on hand, I think it's helped me out in the field quite a bit, is some sort of, I use a squeeze bottle of contact solution. So just basically sterile saline, or not even fully sterile, just something that you can use to irrigate an eye or a wound.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be a big container, like an 8-ouncer, but something around 4 or under will work too, just so you can get some pressure behind it and irrigate out those eyes. I had just this year, a hunt that was nearly ruined by a foreign body that got between that third eyelid there, you know, in the middle, and then the eye itself and a dog. And he just pretty much quit hunting because he just was so focused on that, as I would be as well.
Yeah.
With something far smaller. So we had to take a break and get that irrigated out because I couldn't grab it any other way. And that saved the hunt. So that's just one thing, you know, like I said, for wounds, getting out some debris, that's just something that's easy to carry.
Yeah.
And works well.
It does. And in fact, I was going through mine not a couple days ago, and I found my bottle in there, and it had not leaked all over everything else. So I was pretty stoked.
Right. I might have to get that manufacturer from you. Mine every once in a while, I'll find it empty. And I'm like, popped open yet again.
Yeah. All right. So then, vis-a-vis what we've just talked about, you sit there every day in your veterinarian office when you're not counting money, trying to figure out why these people don't do all the things that you tell them to do, and thus they have to come back. If there's one thing you should tell us all to stop doing to our dogs, what would it be? Besides the overfeeding.
Yeah, that's a tough one. That one is so foremost in my mind. It's hard to come up with a number two, but you're going to have to give me a little time to think on that one.
Well, flip the coin.
I would say, I'll put it this way. It's not so much a medical thing that I think about as it is a behavioral thing.
Yeah.
So a lot of the things I encounter with patients are dogs that are just not properly handled. And that, you know, it saves so much time and energy and money for the owner if you do those things that all the good bird dog trainers are recommending that you do. You know, you handle them, you get in the oral cavity and mess around when they're puppies, you handle their feet, you groom them, you're looking in their ears and all those things where they're going to show resistance when they're 8 weeks old, but this is the time that you establish that relationship so that when it comes time that you need a broken nail pulled off or you need to have a piece of cheatgrass removed from an ear, you don't have to bring out the big sedatives just to do a simple thing. The dog understands that, okay, it's okay for someone in a position of authority to handle my extremities, you know.
Yeah.
I would say that would make my job so much easier. Certainly the technician's job way easier. And then it would save you money too. Because then you're not paying so much. You don't have to have me trim the nails every 3 weeks or whatever they need to be done. And And then, you know, I don't have to sedate everything that comes in.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's good. And how about the things we should start doing to our dogs that, well, you just kind of alluded to that. So I'm not going to be redundant and ask it again. Never mind. But I do believe in that. And boy, it comes in handy. As I think I told you earlier, my dog not literally knocked one of his nails off. I mean, we found the whole thing, just like a shed pronghorn.
Yeah.
The whole thing just laying there on the carpet. And the only way I could get him doctored was because I'd been messing with his feet since he was a puppy.
Sure. And when you reach that point, there's not a whole lot you can do with it anyway. Because usually when I get involved is when it's dangling there by just the thread and I just hold him still and yank it the rest of the way off.
Ow.
Yeah, I mean, we go through the process of like doing it gently. But like most things like that, you just need to grab it and yank real hard and move on. And it stops hurting.
Yeah, yeah. So we're in the midst of that right now. Wish me luck. Well, I've got a long list, so let's jump right into it. Some of these from Facebook, some of these are emails, some of these have been a couple phone messages. Omar Amazkita asks this: does the snake vaccine and the Lyme vaccine, are they really legitimate? Are they things we should really invest in?
I think for both of those items, I would say I'd give a little more credence to the rattlesnake vaccine, although people will argue that point. I do not vaccinate for Lyme, although I'm not in a Lyme endemic area. But from what I gather from my colleagues around the country, that has been met with mixed reviews in terms of its efficacy. So that's one you could probably keep off your list, and then try to work on controlling the exposure in terms of the ticks and the time of year you're out.
Yeah.
Now jumping, and that's about all I can say on that because again, we're not in an area where I see that a lot. So in my experience, it's not something we do stock in, but we hardly ever administer that vaccine.
Great.
Now on the flip side of that, the rattlesnake vaccine, I did a piece for Meat Eater on this very topic. It's controversial, and the controversy lies in the fact that it's hard to gauge the efficacy because you would need essentially the same dog with and without the vaccine get the same exact kind of bite in the same spot to see if, which is obviously an impossible scenario to recreate. In my practice, we tend to give it for high risk, so dogs that are going to be in the rattlesnake area often. We tend to give it, and subjectively, it seems to help. It seems to reduce the severity of the reaction when they have a bite. So if the dog was going to instantly go into anaphylaxis and die, it may just have a severe but not deadly reaction. And then sort of middle of the road, it might go to something that's more mild.
And, you know, you look at what you've invested in a bird dog, and that's not even counting the emotional side of things. What's a round of rattlesnake vaccination? $50 well, maybe?
Sure. I mean, if you booster it in with your annual vaccinations, it's 25,
there you go.
50 or something like that at a clinic. So yeah, a good for peace of mind. Again, some dogs do create a reaction to the vaccine, and that's where the controversy among my colleagues lies. And I just haven't seen that in an appreciable way, but they certainly have, and they don't give it. But I think it's 25 to 20 to 30, 50, whatever you want to throw out there. Bend, you know, where you live, maybe it's 100. I don't know.
No, I don't go to those veterinarians.
Yeah, there's a few out there for sure. But it's money well spent in terms of peace of mind, in my opinion. And it could be a lifesaver, too.
Well, that's how I look at it as well. And, you know, there's a related question coming up down the road a little bit. So so stand by if you're really interested in this topic, everybody. Mike DeCarolis asks, in your opinion, do you see a decline in hunting ability when you spay or neuter a dog versus an intact dog?
Oh, I like this question because it really ticks off one subset of people. So
yeah, I know who you mean. Yeah.
Well, I can kind of speak from both scientific side and from personal experience. Mm-hmm. On the scientific side, I've always said this. I said that the drive to hunt comes between the ears and not between the legs. So that is, I think the desire to point, track, prey drive is buried deep in their essence of being down in their DNA, and it's not affiliated with their desire to procreate. I think that, in fact, it can be a bit of a distraction if you've got a bitch in season, or you have a have an intact male and they're both running at the same time. But see which one hunts more. And on a personal side, I've got one of each, and I can tell you they both have drive for days. And I can't, you would, if, you know, if you couldn't just look and tell, you'd never know which one was the one that had been altered. So I don't buy it. People that train hundreds and hundreds of dogs a year or in a lifetime probably have another opinion and based on their experience. But from a scientific perspective, I don't buy it. From my own personal experience, I don't buy it. So
well, let's put to rest the second half of this question, and that is, if we must, for whatever reason we believe is the right reason, if we must spay or neuter a dog, what's the youngest we should probably do that to ensure that our dog has fully developed all of their physiological capabilities?
Sure. And, you know, you kind of asked me to be succinct in my answers, and this is one that it's hard not to open up a can of worms. The short answer about all of those, whenever you're deciding to do it or not to do it, or when to do it and the minimum age to do it, it's really all about what risks you're most comfortable with. Mm-hmm. Some people have had experience with a late in life pyometra or uterine infection for a female that's been left intact too long. That's a big issue for them. Some of them end up having mammary tumors later in life. They want to stay earlier to avoid that risk or at least reduce that risk. If you're just an in-home pet where it's inconvenient for the family to endure heat cycles, or it's a male that you don't really want the bravado going along with being intact. I mean, a bare minimum 6 months, and that would be just in a pet animal. But I think for an active dog, male or female in our bird dog category, the longer you can wait, I think in terms of orthopedic issues, some types of tumors, I would try to get them in the minimum 18 months. That's just, yeah. I kind of cringe going any earlier than that.
Great. But, and just for the record, does neutering a male dog reduce their aggressiveness?
No, I don't believe so. Now it might reduce conflicts over if the resource that the fight is about is an intact female. Sure. I could see that. Yeah. See that maybe happening, but I think the aggression is a psychological state. I don't think it is necessarily manipulated by sex hormones in that regard. Some of the most aggressive males I have ever been around have been castrated.
I believe it.
I can say that.
Yeah. Well, good. All right. We put that one to rest completely. End of sentence. Carolyn Mill Markle asks, is there anything you can give your dog in the field to relax them enough to pull porcupine quills?
Ooh, that's a tough one.
I'd pay any amount for that, whatever it is.
Right, like some chloroform in a rag and just kind of put them. That would be fantastic. Sadly, I can't think of anything. And part of the problem is those quills are often going to be around the mouth, and you're going to have to give something orally.
Yeah.
I mean, I have some stuff in my truck, but again, you need to go to vet school and have a DEA license to kind of have your hands on that. So. And I can give that in the vein. But generally speaking, that's a tough one. And if you feel, and I give this advice to anybody, know your comfort level with putting your hands, and know your dog too. If there's a good risk you're going to get bit, then just let a professional handle it with the proper sedatives.
Yeah.
But yeah, man, if there was a magic pill, you could just pop them and they just lay there and let you do whatever. I'd probably give half of my patients that when they walked in the vet clinic door.
Oh, I believe it. Yeah, whether they got quills in them or not. You know, the definition of a true friend is the one who will hold your dog while you pull the quills out.
Right. That's what I tell people. I said, have your friend pull the quills while you hold your dog, because you kind of know mostly how to do that.
Yeah. Clarkson Rollins asks a related question in jest, I'm pretty sure. He asks, when you're going to start selling that anti-porcupine vaccine?
Right. It would be a miracle drug, because I think once, I feel like over half of the dogs get a little taste of it, they just crave it more the next time.
Yeah. You know, that is the cliche, you know, half those dogs want to get revenge.
I believe it. They're sitting there as they're drugged and I'm pulling them out. They're contemplating the next strategy. Yeah. I'm going to do this differently. I'm going to get that son of a gun next time.
We got a whole bunch more. Elsa, Diane, Deborah, Angie, Michael, we're all going to get to your questions in a few minutes. But right now, I want to remind you that in a moment or two, we'll be talking about handling your dog, the care and feeding of your own bird dog. Before we get to that, though, here is our newest sponsor. And hey, Seth, maybe you know Tim Hunt. Dr. Tim's Performance Dog Food has just joined the sponsorship list here at the Upland Nation podcast. If you want to learn more about the food that I've been feeding for a long time, I know slow is better than never. Thank you, Tim, for joining the crowd. Learn more at Dr. That's DrTims.com. DrTims.com. 5-star ratings, all sorts of great stuff. Tim is a sled dog racer and knows all about performance in dogs and in performance dog food. Learn more at drtims.com. And then espamerica.com. They're my choice when it comes to hearing protection. One of the nicest things about it is they don't pull any punches. They don't make any bones about it. Go to the first page on their website and you can comparison shop all the choices that they offer you. You can decide what's important, what's not important, whether it comes to price, whether it comes to performance, what kind of performance. It's all right there at espamerica.com. Okay, handle it is what we call this segment. This is where I share with you all the mistakes I've made so that you don't have to when it comes to your dog. And we got an expert on the other end of the line with us as well in Seth Bynum, doctor of veterinary medicine. You know, I do a lot of traveling, and one of the things that that really has frustrated me with Flick as a young wire hair is once we get in the truck and cross the county line, he refuses to eat, and he's skinny enough already to where I will just about do anything to get him to eat when he's supposed to. I don't feed in the morning of a hunt, so we're already behind the curve there. I want to feed him more, and I want him to eat more whenever he is able to at the end of the day and on an off day when we're traveling and things like that. I figured out that I've got about 4 go-to items. The first is canned cat food. Mix that in with your dry dog food and all of a sudden, Katie bar the door. Another one, eggs from the hotel breakfast buffet. If you can get those out the door and into your dog, he'll eat anything attached to it, which is what I do with it. I bury them underneath the kibble. Seth, as a veterinarian, is there anything that you might suggest we do that would also help get our dogs to eat a little bit more when they're less inclined to do that?
You know, I tend to use a probiotic product that is usually highly palatable and adds flavor to the meal, but also keeps their gut bacteria stable while you're traveling. I think that's a big thing to do there, too. I kind of cringe at your cat food recommendation just from my experiences, usually outside of our bird dog pets. But I think the eggs is actually a pretty solid idea. I may have to borrow that one from you.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. You feel bad because I don't eat much in the morning either. But when I'm walking, I'm such a cheapskate. I grew up poor. So if I'm walking past the free buffet, I'm going to get something. I'm going to do something with it afterwards. And now I've got a real good excuse for it.
Sure. I've been known to stuff a bagel in my pocket for the road.
All right. So probiotic, and we know who the providers are of that stuff. I had no idea it was flavored, and maybe that's what I, maybe because the last time I asked the Purina guys what one of their products tasted like, they looked at me funny.
But try it. I do all the time.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, just to see what the experience is like. Yeah. Can vouch for it.
Oh, great. Well, I'll be looking for that then. I'll have to call Carl and get some of that stuff and see how it works on Flick. You're on the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden, your host. That's Seth Bynum. He's a doctor of veterinary medicine. And let's get back to some of the questions here. This one from a good friend of mine. She's also very active. In fact, thank you for all your hard work on behalf of Quail Forever. Elsa Gallagher asks, if you will enlighten us to nocardia and pyothorax. First, you have to say it 3 times fast, and then you have to tell us what it is.
Sure. Yeah. Nocardia being a type of bacteria, and then pyothorax would be a, you know, essentially the term means pyo is pus and thorax is you know, chest. Oh, so
I'm already disgusted. Hold it. Give me a minute here. Right. Okay, go ahead.
I just had a patient that dealt with this. It was a German Shepherd, not a bird dog, but essentially in areas of high concentrations of grass awns or cheatgrass in my neck of the woods and yours, those little awns migrate through the skin and they can go pretty much wherever they darn well please. And sometimes they'll make a hard right and penetrate the pleural cavity and like end up within the chest itself between the lung and then the inside of that wall. And then of course they bring with them bacteria among them, Cardia be one that's prevalent, others too. And that's just, they'll set up a pretty serious life-threatening infection in that space. That space is supposed to be sterile, right? You put any kind of bacteria in there, it's like, woohoo, this is an awesome place to set up shop.
So, and just for the record, that's not the same as foreign body pneumonia, which is an inhaled seed, right?
Well, I think either way, I mean, they're all sort of similar. It's by the mechanism that the same grass on could have been swallowed and worked its way along the esophagus and in there too. So it's a mess. However it happens, whatever species of pathogen is involved, I want to avoid it at all costs.
Yeah, so do I. We've been there and done that, and we don't want to do it again. That's why you talk about, conditioning your dog for eye exams and all of that. Well, that is the main reason. We haven't had a real bad cheatgrass year in quite a while out here, but I still check between every toe. I check the nose, the gums, the lips, eyes, ears, and any other orifice. And yes, it does go up those too. Maybe you haven't treated one of those yet, but apparently it's not very fun.
It's correct. I've pulled several out of the vulva of a dog. It'll find, because they squat to pee.
It kind
of finds its way right up in there.
Okay. So the lesson is look carefully after every hunt. Well, every day, actually. We go out every day, and the first thing we negotiate is amber waves of cheatgrass. So
sure. Put a check in the positive column for short hairs in that regard, so they're a little less prone. But your wire hairs are going to be ones you need to be very thorough when you come out of the field.
Oh yeah, and then I look at all those other like setters and springers and things like that. I just cannot imagine how you would give a dog like that a thorough going over. But you really ought to anyway. Another question about toenails. Diane Plosica Struger. Hope I got that right, Diane, has a Munsterlander that has broken and split toenails regularly, and it's only 8 months old. Is there anything we can give a dog that will help strengthen those, or is the solution really what I need to be better at, and that's keeping those trimmed back?
Yeah, hard to say without seeing the dog in that scenario, but I think you're probably onto something with your recommendation. I think most broken nails that I see, in fact, I'd say almost all of them come from nails that have been allowed to grow too long. And with a breed like that, that's going to have some longer hair on the feet, you may be surprised how much is actually getting out there. And so keeping them trimmed and short is probably the best recommendation. I can't really think of a strong supplement that might enhance the integrity of those, although there are some dogs that just have genetically brittle nails too, but usually they're long.
There's white nails and there's black nails, and there's probably variations on both. Have you ever seen a difference in the, I don't know what to call it, the hardiness of a white nail versus a black nail?
No experiments have been done. I would say since you asked, I've never actually even thought about it. I would say typically the white ones tend to be a little bit more brittle. I don't even know if that's just anecdotal or coincidence or anything like that. So can't say to that for sure.
I could see where Diane got this notion. If you believe the television advertising, you can make your fingernails stronger by putting things in your mouth. How that works is beyond me, but anyway, it's a legitimate question, and I'm glad we could address it. Deborah Hicks Kindle asked another question, and we've kind of touched on a few of these already. Prevention of tick-borne diseases, number one. Are you a fan of the oral? What do we call those things anymore? I don't want to call them an insecticide, but that's basically what they are, aren't they?
Yeah, antiparasitic. Yeah. And they're just keep in mind, these are compounds that are only sensitive to the insect spectrum, the way they metabolize, the way their nerves work. So people get freaked out about putting poison in their dogs. And, you know, I can't think of any serious illness that has occurred from any preventive that we've ever sold, but I can point to a lot of cases of death from tick-borne illness. So I think it's worth rolling the dice on that. It's not even, it's actually a no-brainer, to be honest with you. But I'm a big fan of the orals. Bravecto is one we go to often. I've seen just a handful out of the thousands of tablets that we've sold of dogs that maybe go off food for a day or maybe vomit once or twice. That'd be the extent of it. I've not seen any seizures or anything like that. That tends to be the one that I give my own dogs and one that we sell frequently.
Okay. Angie Barron asks, let's see here. Curious your opinion on age appropriate intensity and types of exercise for young developing dogs. And I understand what she means. And she goes on to ask about bone damage, joint damage, that sort of thing. And you know, the two words that come up in my thought are growth plates, but maybe there's a better way to talk about that, Seth.
Yeah, that's a tough one because I'm not a veterinary orthopedist. So I'm not quoting research here with my opinion. I think having owned bird dogs and having owned young bird dogs, I know that there's really, you need to be able to run them. Otherwise, you can't really live with them. So you have to make some sort of compromise there. And that may be jogging when they're still having young and fast growing bones. You're going to do some heavy work on unfused growth plates. It's just going to happen. I can't say that I've seen in practice bird dogs that have had, osteoarthritis from early activity. Now, if you get into dogs that start to get overweight, then yeah, we can start to see that. I've also never seen any sort of growth plate damage that wasn't caused from something traumatic like being hit by a car, falling out the back of a truck. That's a common one too. Those growth plates they like to snap in those locations. The bones do. I just think be smart about it. And then of course, if you have concerns about your particular dog, you need to really consult with your vet. That's why we're here. And then you'll get some differing opinions, but just use common sense and then use what your gut tells you about it. I've taken young puppies on little jogs and I've let them run big in fields. And I've also like held some back when I was afraid that it might be too hard on their joints. Just kind of depends.
Good. All right. The whole controversy of grain-free dog food is a topic. You know, you ask any two bird dog owners about dog food and you'll get three opinions. Michael Siegler asks what your opinion is on the grain-free dog food hullabaloo.
Thanks, Michael. I'm really glad for the chance to tee off on this, and I'll really try to keep it brief because it truly is a marketing ploy. So they have the pet food industry is super profitable. Let's not have pull any punches on that. That is the case for sure. So everybody wants to get involved. As a species, we are totally anti-carb. We are super keto this and celiac that. And I feel like it's not, there are some true cases of that, of course, among us. But in general, we have vilified carbs for the last decade or so. That has spilled over into our pet food such that we have viewed anything that's not sort of like an ingredient that has just like, you know, a potato or some sort of primary meat protein as some kind of filler, which I think is completely irrelevant. I think we are about to see with this FDA surveying of these grain-free diets and its link to cardiomyopathy. So this dilated cardiomyopathy we're seeing now, I think we're going to come to the end of the craze. And the first little indicator I had of that was on my Facebook feed of all places. An advertisement pops up, I guess it thinks I'm interested in this particular pet food company, who's one of the most commonly cited foods within those cases the FDA is investigating, put a tagline at the bottom, now with wholesome grains. And I'm like, this is how it's going to work. They're going to add grains back in and say it was their idea the whole time. It's dangerous. And let's not pretend that because they're not using corn, wheat, barley, or one of those type grains in the food, that they're not putting carbohydrates in there. In fact, it's those carbohydrate supplements in many of those forms, like soy, some of the tapioca flours, or using sweet potatoes, they're getting carbs. And it's those kind of ingredients they've added in that have actually been what they believe is linked to those cardiac issues. So the amino acids are getting thrown off and the foods are not, are no longer balanced.
Well, so. Thank you. No, and I mean that. I'm not being facetious. But that is enlightening. I never quite understood that before. And so, yeah, let's keep an open mind.
Sure.
Okay, so one of the things that I tout all the time in my little, and my dog first aid kit is relatively concise as well, or else I wouldn't carry it. You know, that's the thing. It's just like a survival kit. If it's so big and bulky, you're not going to carry it, and then what good is it doing you? But John Bilodeau asks about one of my favorite ingredients in that kit, and it is Benadryl. He asks specifically, would it help in the case of snake bite? Now, the snake bite, different than a bee sting.
Yes.
Going to help in one or both cases?
Definitely. I think both. And it was interesting because when I wrote a piece about that, I had a human physician kind of like, you know, jump in and give their opinion that it's not a histamine type reaction in a bee sting. And that is absolutely, I mean, I'm sorry.
In the snake bite. Yeah.
In the snake bite. Correct. So, and I'm like, well, we don't technically know what's happening, but I can tell you that Benadryl does work and it has saved. I mean, when I'm on call and we have people that are upriver, you know, 2 or 3 hours away call, we're the closest veterinarian. They've encountered a snake and the dog's been bitten. There can be serious improvement that can occur on just the Benadryl alone on that 3-hour drive into the clinic.
Okay.
So it may not be a classic histamine reaction that the antihistamine Benadryl is perfect for, but we don't really know all the things that the dog is reacting to. Is it the venom? Is it the saliva? Is it the bacteria of the oral cavity of the snake that's now been placed in the skin? There's all kinds of things the body's reacting to at a snake bite.
Yeah.
Not just the venom. So yeah, heck yeah. Have it on hand.
What's the best kind to have on hand? People talk about children's Benadryl liquid versus the capsules. What should we carry?
I carry adult Benadryl, and I carry because that way you get the more of the drug in a smaller package. And then there's sometimes I'm not sure of all the ingredients in the children's. I don't want anything that's got xylitol, that sort of artificial sweetener, for reasons we can go into another time. But I just carry the like little blister packs of non-chewable adult Benadryl, and then you know practice pilling your dog, learning how to do it.
Yeah.
It's pretty easy to do by shoving it way back in the back of the throat. But, you know, and then just the dose is simple. It's 1 milligram per pound. You know, that's a kind of a cut and dry, well, almost crude dose. And they probably get a little sleepy. But if you need to give it, then you need to give a good dose.
You know, I don't know that getting your dog a little sleepy after a snake bite is such a bad idea anyway.
Oh, added bonus for sure.
Yeah, good. Okay, adult 1 milligram per pound. That's great information. I'm going to go double check and make sure that I got enough in mine. Gage Cantrell, thanks for your question about first aid must-haves in the kit. We've covered a whole bunch of that already, and good job there. I hope you have it all. Felton Jenkins and Scott Fuller both asked about the neutering question. We dealt with that. Todd Grassy has, this is hilarious, Todd Grassy asks about grass allergies.
Yeah.
Which, let's broaden that a little because I talked to somebody a few days ago and whether it's an ear issue or scratching or something like that, can dogs get those kind of allergies from grass and pollen and that sort of thing?
Absolutely. Yeah. And then, you know, whereas humans have, we tend to have our respiratory tract as our allergic responsive organs.
Yeah.
The dog's skin seems to be that way in addition to their GI tract. But for the most part, it's the skin that reacts. So I think there's all sorts of things that can set off dogs' immune system to be hyperactive. I think as clinicians, we generally beat our heads against the wall because I would say that a good chunk of our appointments are related to those kind of issues, and they're often unrewarding cases. But yeah, there's, in fact, in recent years, it's just gotten better in terms of the products that we can offer to sort of mask the symptoms. But getting to the root of the problem is often super challenging, unrewarding, and we never really find out the how or the why. We just know how to cover it up and they get better.
Yeah. Yeah. How about, Omar asked another question later on in the evening. Supplementations for joint health, glucosamine, I guess, chondroitin, that sort of thing, whether we should bother with that? And actually, maybe when we should start it if we're going to do it at all?
I think it's a good one. Yeah, and it depends on the formulation. Keep in mind, these things are what they call nutraceuticals. So they're the amount of these of those particular substances within the thing you're giving is not necessarily regulated and will vary manufacturer to manufacturer. I'll say
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
I hesitate to recommend, if a dog is having osteoarthritis from a problem that's linked back to its obesity, I'm almost reticent to recommend even a joint supplement treat that is then going to supplant, because they're usually pretty calorie rich too. So I worry about that too, but I we sell them often and they do seem to help some. I think there's a lot of prescription diets that can add in a lot more of those substances, those chondroitin and just omega-3s that are going to be helpful for inflammation as well than you can get just from supplementation alone.
Oh, that's good to know. You're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden. That's Seth Bynum on the other end. He's a veterinarian, but he's also one of us. And in fact, Seth, I apologize. I haven't given you a moment or two to brag on your dogs. Tell me about your hunting dogs.
Oh, thanks. I have two short hairs, and I tell people I have this like fatal attraction to the breed. You know, they drive me absolutely crazy, but I just can't help myself. Yeah. I have an 11-year-old male. He just turned 11 this last week. And then I have a 4-year-old female, and the male's out of Lyons in Oregon. And then the female's kind of a combination of Oregon and Wisconsin. Both are heavy Navda bred dogs and tested in that discipline. And we do a lot of bird hunting from Washington State, Idaho, Montana, and kind of different species. They're a lot of fun. I mean, they're very different types of dogs too. One's more of like the meat and potatoes kind of dog, and the other one's like a real flashy pointer that likes to point no matter what in situations, sometimes whether there's a bird there or not. So, both have been very different to train. One's a real knucklehead and would prefer a 2x4, and the other one takes a real light hand, and it's always something, you know, with them to keep me busy.
Isn't that the truth though? And I remember the times when I've run two dogs or owned two dogs at the same time. I was, for a while there, I was so disappointed that they were different from each other. But after a few months in the field, I realized that's kind of part of the fun as well.
Oh yeah. It's like different personalities come out in them too. And, you know, and I'll always try to make time, especially for the younger one towards the end of the season, to run her by herself. And
yeah,
she always shows me something that impresses me that the other guy, old guy, can't do, and kind of vice versa. So I haven't really been comfortable with passing the torch yet because he's still hunting really hard at 11, but I do try to reserve some time just for her to show off this time of the year.
That's great. So far, what's been the highlight of your hunting season?
Oh, we had an awesome trip to Montana. The bird numbers are still pretty down from, you know, a couple of bad winters in a row.
Yeah.
We did get, our pheasants. We had to work super hard for it. I don't know how many of your listeners were out there during that kind of second, third week of pheasant season, but the weather just came in and smacked us right in the face. I mean, it was bitter, bitter cold. So we kind of had to, there's a couple of days we couldn't even hunt, which if you knew me, you'd know that is saying a whole lot, because you know, we're talking single digits with 20 mile an hour winds. I mean, just dangerously cold out there for standing around. So, but we had a great trip. It was beautiful country, and we killed a lot of birds, including a lot of waterfowl, which was fun. Seeing that 4-year-old short hair retrieve some geese out of icy water, which kind of scared me, but excited me at the same time, as many of you probably can relate to. And then we did a great trip, sort of a meat eater kind of fun hunt that you might see later on YouTube, kind of down in Hell's Canyon. So, for checkers and hounds, keep your eyes out for that one.
I'm just on the other side of that from you, well, in about 6 hours drive, but I have yet to visit Hell's Canyon on a hunting trip. I've fished that area several times, but I've just not been there for a bird hunt, and I'm embarrassed to admit it.
Well, I don't think you need to be, because like I tell people, I'd never been down there either. I was sort of a guest and invited down. I had to drive by a lot of good checker hunting to get to that checker hunting. So I typically don't have any reason to go there. And, you know, as you get closer to that sort of Treasure Valley epicenter,
yeah,
that's ever growing outside of Boise, you see more pressure. And that's not something that I was prepared for, you know, or ever really seen in the Chukar Hills at all. So it was a different perspective, but still lots of fun.
You know, it's funny.
Beautiful.
It's same for a little bit further south. I won't name the places that I go that are slightly south of there, but yeah, it has been discovered by the Boise metropolitan area.
Yeah. I can relate. So
yeah. Okay.
That's good. I'm glad more people are getting out there though, you know, and then the more people buying licenses and getting out there and hunting, even if it affects one or two of my spots, I think it's better for the sustainability of the sport.
Oh, don't get me started on that. It's a pet peeve. I lecture everybody all the time about it. In fact, they're probably going to hear something later in the podcast yet again. you know, that's how you get that point across, and you're absolutely right. Final question for you regarding all this kind of stuff, including Hell's Canyon or any place else you're going that you'd have to kill me if you told me where it was. I'm like you. I'm out there almost, almost every time I can get away, I'm chasing wild chuckers somewhere, and I'm carrying a lot of water. When it comes to carrying all that water for you, how are you doing it? What are you dispensing it into or onto for your dogs, and how do you just pack it all around?
Well, I feel like a Sherpa some days, especially yeah. Early season. So mm-hmm. I tend to save my chukar spots for, like I said, for this time of year when I don't have to, you know, rely on the water sources as much. Mm-hmm. I carry it in hydration bladders. I've done that for years. I also keep a couple of squirt bottles in my vest too, and anything where I could like minimize waste. So I'm not in terms of garbage waste, but water spillage, or, you know, I can squirt directly in the dog's mouth with the hose at the little nipple tip, or like the squirt bottle. This seems to work really well. I've hunted with guys that use bowls, and I feel like there's a lot of fussing around and then water that doesn't get consumed that gets dumped out, and that stuff you were previously carrying around that you now wasted. So
I'm the same way. I just can't see throwing away water once I've carried it 4 miles up a hill.
I know.
Well, good, and good on you, and I hope the rest of your season goes well. That's Seth Bynum. He's a veterinarian out of the Lewiston area. You can also find him at Bird Dog Vet on Instagram and at themeateater.com, where he authors a column called Ask the Vet. All good stuff and all enjoyable to learn more about. Seth, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thanks for being on the Upland Nation podcast.
Oh, you're welcome, Scott. It was a lot of fun.
Be safe for the rest of the season. Maybe I'll see you over in Hell's Canyon next year.
I sure hope not.
Okay, man. See ya. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
But don't you go away. We've got a lot more coming up here. What a great guy. I would love to go hunting with Seth Bynum someday. But for now, we'll be going to North Dakota. I've got a tip for you in our This Land Is Your Land feature coming up right after a word from Dogtra, where the T&B Dual is available to you. That's their two-dog, one handheld controller system. 10% off if you use this code, SLUN10. At dogtra.com. Free shipping on anything over $200 as well. So you're getting a sweet deal if you just remember where you heard about it, right here on the Upland Nation podcast. Dogtra.com. The code again, SLUN10 for a 10% discount. Go on over there and take a look at a video that was shot the day before we arrived at Grand Seal Lodge in South Dakota, where they showed off the T&B Dual with my friend and guide and dog handler and trainer and breeder, Corey Hart. And let's enjoy a little bit of quality time in North Dakota. You know, I've been at Mott, North Dakota, Dickinson, North Dakota, and had a great time in both of those places several times. And one of the visits to Mott, we ended up going about 60 miles west to the Little Missouri National Grassland. It was not pheasant season, so we were chasing sharptails. And I was a little surprised because there's a lot of hills that might be called mountains over there east of the Mississippi. They didn't look like classic sharptail habitat, but they're often covered with the same kind of shin to knee-high grass in the bottoms. They got snowberry and buffaloberry and other shrubby thickets. And there are birds to go along with all that good-looking habitat, even though there's a lot of verticality in there as well. I'll never forget introducing my good friend Joe Exum from North Carolina to sharptail hunting there. He was at the bottom of the hill, somebody was at the top, and we were all spread out in between. That bird passed the whole gamut, past four other guys flying downhill before Joe dropped it. Congratulations, Joe, on your first Western game bird. And this is probably a good place to remind you that I do have a new website, and it's all about finding places like the Little Missouri National Grassland. Mark this down, add it to your favorites list, findbirdhuntingspots.com. I'm always looking for new places, and when I find a good one and I can walk around on it, I'm going to give you an honest description of how it works, all the places I've been. You know, I've hunted in almost 30 states now, and I have good correspondents in all the others who are feeding me information that I can trust and you can trust too. It's all at findbirdhuntingspots.com. And a quick reminder, espamerica.com is where you'll find the highest quality. Hey, I use them. Hearing protection devices, custom fit. They'll stay in even in the field. I put them in every time. I put the dog on the ground as well as at the range. espamerica.com. And that's about it for this week's edition of the Upland Nation podcast. Thank you again to Seth Bynum, Doctor of Veterinary Medicine. Thank you all, Todd, Michael, John, and everybody else who asked a question for Seth. Hope you got some good answers. Tell your friends. Please share. And if you'll do me a big favor, subscribe or rate or review the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. You want to talk more? Got another question? You got an idea? You want to be on the show? Go to the Upland Nation Facebook page or the Wing Shooting USA Facebook page. You can even leave a message at the new findbirdhuntingspots.com page. I'd love to talk with you, share a hunting story and all sorts of great dog pictures. You know, those are my passions, and I know they are your passions too. Until I see you in the field, thanks again for listening. I'm Scott Linden.